relationship between black hole entropy in loop quantum gravity and Estitucci-Simon theory. This talk is based entirely in a joint work with Jonathan Engel and Karim Nui. Some of it has appeared already on the archives, and there is also a long paper with all the details and the proofs of many of the statements that I will make in this talk that should come out soon in the following weeks. It's almost ready. Some of you have some early copies of this draft. So let me go to the next slide, in which I present more or less the plan of the talk. We'll start with some motivation and introduction, and describing things that everybody knows about classical black holes and semi-classical physics of black holes, and why these systems behave as thermodynamical systems. We'll see that in order to deal with the problem of black holes in loop quantum gravity, one needs to introduce some semi-local, quasi-local definition of black hole, and this is something that has been introduced initially by Ashtekar, Krasnov, and Corici, and there has been certain literature about that. Definition has been improved, has been generalized, and so I will briefly mention these things, and we're going to go then to a special case of this isolated horizons, which what I refer to as the ACK formulation, which corresponds to the spherically symmetric isolated horizons, as initially formulated in the paper that was used as a basis. ACK stands for Ashtekar, Krasnov, for the quantization and the counting that led to the result of the modern result of entropy in loop quantum gravity. In order to illustrate the structure in the SU2 invariant setting, we're going to review the way we introduce these connection variables that we like and love in loop quantum gravity. And so we will see that due to the use of connection variables and the symplectic structure of the system that describes, dynamical system describing isolated horizons, contains a surface term corresponding to an SU2 Chern-Simon theory. And I will finish with a brief description of the quantization and the relationship between the U1 and the SU2 treatments as far as the counting is concerned, and the value of the entropy. So to the next slide, which is slide number 3. There was slide number 2, but I just erased it to make the introduction more brief. So the introduction, it's just known facts about black hole mechanics. So in classical general relativity, one can prove that stationary black holes are uniquely defined by three parameters: their mass, their angular momentum, and their charge. So when one perturbs an initially stationary black hole in a kind of thought experiment, assuming that you throw some matter into a stationary black hole, as in the picture in the slide, then you would perturb the black hole, you would go through a dynamical phase in which gravitational radiation would be emitted or matter radiation might be emitted. But if you wait long enough, you expect on physical grounds to get back to a stationary situation described by a new set of parameters, M prime, J prime, and Q prime. And it turns out that if you study this system from the point of view of general relativity, you obtain a certain number of relations, which one often calls the laws of black hole mechanics, which resemble very much the laws of thermodynamics. The first one is the zeroth law, which says that a geometric quantity called the surface gravity, which is defined up in the transparency under some definitions, is the second line. That surface gravity could be seen or regarded, at least in spherically symmetric case, as kind of the value of the gravitational force at the horizon seen from infinity, but it has a geometric definition in terms of the Killing generator, the Killing vector, the null vector that that there is a generator of horizon and that is normalized so that at infinity it corresponds to time translations of the asymptotically flat space time. So that equation that you see there, so this L, it turns out to be geodesic but not affinely parameterized, and the failure of the L being affinely parameterized has to do with this surface gravity kappa. The Searle's law, we will see that kappa, everybody knows, but I guess in my audience, that kappa will be related with the temperature. So the Searle's law is that this kappa is constant on the horizon. Then you see that if you relate the parameters before and after you have perturbed the black hole, you can prove using Einstein's equations that the first law follows, which is a kind of balance equation resembling the first law of thermodynamics, where it tells you the change in the mass is related with the change of area multiplied by this thing proportional to kappa, plus work terms, as in the first law of thermodynamics. Then you also have the second law, which is a much more general law that comes from the Hawking theorems, that theorem that shows that for general black holes, not necessarily stationary ones, the area of the black hole has to increase. Then there is also the third law, which is not something you can prove exactly, but by looking at examples, thought examples, you get convinced that it's impossible to reach kappa equal to zero, the extremal black hole, by a set of finitely many physical processes. Okay, so we can go to the next slide. So this kappa plays an analogous role of temperature, and so at the beginning, well, there is no temperature in classical general relativity, but then soon after these laws were found, then Hawking proved that if you consider a test field on this collapsing space-time background that ends up forming a black hole, then you can prove that if you consider the quantum test field, then you can prove that if you started with initial conditions where the field was in vacuum as observers, faraway observers in the past is concerned, then future late observers, more precisely observers, asymptotically late observers on SCRI, on the future null infinity, would perceive a flow of particles coming from the space-time, from the black hole, at a given temperature, which is given by kappa divided by 2 pi. So this semi-classical analysis makes the analogy now a strict physical statement about black hole mechanics. So black holes behave as thermodynamical objects. The kappa is associated with the temperature and one-fourth of the area with the entropy of black hole, as it follows from the first and second law. So we can go to the next slide. But so if black holes radiate, they must lose energy. So if we go beyond the semi-classical approximation in which the field is a test field and therefore the background is just always the same, and we include in some way back reaction, we expect that the black hole would be losing energy in terms of thermal radiation, and so a black hole would shrink and eventually will evaporate, and it might evaporate completely. So this raises all sorts of questions that have to be addressed in the context of quantum gravity. So those questions, or some of these questions that that are for me the most important ones, is the questions you see in this list on page 5. The macroscopic, what is the microscopic origin of entropy? What is the dynamics of black hole evaporation? What replaces the classical singularity that we have inside the black hole? And what happens when the black hole completely evaporates? In loop quantum gravity, all of these questions have been addressed with different levels of precision. And there are very beautiful results about concerning 2, 3, and 4 recent results. I will not mention any of these things in my talk. I will concentrate on point 1, namely what is the microscopic origin of this entropy. So we can, and before going to next slide, so one thing that is already apparent from the picture I've drawn in this slide is that the concept of black hole, as we define it in the classical theory, can obviously not be taken literally to the quantum theory. It might even be, depends on the answer we give to question 3 and 4, that that definition would be completely wrong in the quantum theory. It might be that, so the usual definition is that the black hole region corresponds to the part of space-time that is outside the past of future scry. And depending on what the full theory tells us about 2, 3, and 4, it might be that that kind of notion doesn't even exist, in doesn't even make sense in the quantum theory. So one needs to carefully analyze what do we mean by black hole in order to answer the first question. And what looks reasonable is to provide some definition which is quasi-local. So we want to try to define something that defines a region of space-time that for a certain amount of time behaves approximately like a black hole horizon. And this is, so we can go to the next slide, slide number 6. This is the idea behind the notion of isolated horizons that was initially introduced in ACK by Ashtekar, Korichi, and Krasnov. So I like to give an intuitive picture of what that is, and so that intuitive picture can be provided if we, for a moment, think of the characteristic formulation of general relativity. So consider two null surfaces. So we look at the green diagram. If you have two null surfaces which intersect and have a non-trivial domain of dependence, a non-trivial, the green region, bounded on the past by some spatial surface that I regard as an initial Cauchy data surface, then Einstein's equations can be formulated in this region in two ways. One can give initial data on the Cauchy surface. This is what I represent in the green diagram, and evolve Einstein's equations to find uniquely up to gauge, so up to diffeomorphisms and other gauges if they are internal gauges, depending on the kind of variables we use. One can reproduce uniquely in that sense the physical fields in the domain of dependence, D plus of M. Alternatively, one can give free characteristic data. The initial Cauchy data, of course, have to be have to satisfy the usual constraints, of course. Alternatively, one can give, as in the yellow diagram, free characteristic data and evolve backwards the Einstein's equations to obtain a unique solution in the plus, so that we can the two things are equivalent, and this is one-to-one correspondence between the two ways, at least locally, as far as we don't go too locally in some sense, it has to be well-defined. So these pictures then allow me to present in an intuitive way what an isolated horizon is. An isolated horizon, now look at the diagram below, the white and black and white diagram, corresponds to an infinite set, an infinite dimensional set of solutions of Einstein's equations in which I give some very special characteristic data on one of the null surfaces, which I also will require to have some topological, to satisfy some topology requirements, as I say in a moment, while I give absolutely free data on the transversal null surface. So this shows that isolated horizons will be an infinite dimensional set of solutions of Einstein's equation. The idea would be to regard these solutions from the point of view of the covariant phase space, give it, regard this as our dynamical system and our covariant phase space, and quantize that sector of the theory to try to answer the question number one, namely, what is the origin of the of black hole entropy. So this defines the setting up of the problem. So I can be a little bit more precise about the ACK, isolated horizon boundary condition, and this is the list of properties that you have written there. This is not meant to be a precise definition, but to give the essential essential ingredients of the definition. If I assume that there is no matter, to simplify things even further, then the first point is to require that the topology of delta. Remember from now on that when I talk about delta, I mean this null surface, which is the isolated horizon. The topology has to be S2 cross R. We require Einstein's equations to hold on delta, and we require the null normal L to this delta to be expansion-free, rho equal to zero, and shear-free, sigma equal to zero. This will, by, in particular, imply that the area of this the cross-section of the cross-sections of the horizon do not grow. The area is constant. In the original ACK formulation, one also requires the null vector field N, which is normalized so that N scalar L is equal to 1. It has zero shear and has an expansion which is negative but spherically symmetric. So it depends only on V. V, this is a coordinate along a transversal coordinate along the generators L. So we can go to the next. One more thing. I have put this in red because there are some more modern definitions of isolated horizons in which this condition is relaxed a little bit. I must say that what we've done so far is to study the SU2 gauge invariant formulation of that definition. And working with the more general definitions is something that we are thinking about, and we think we can do it also. But from now on, think that I'm restricting to the ACK formulation, which involves this property written there. So we can go to the next slide.
Alex, can I just make one quick comment?
Yes.
Okay. So the statement is just that, I agree with what you just said, that one can probably extend the whole thing to the more general definition. But just for everybody in the audience, what is not so good about the old definition is that some of the equations you wrote down refer not just to the intrinsic geometry of the isolated horizon, but also to kind of the vector field N, which kind of sticks out of the isolated horizon and its derivatives, whereas the new definitions really talk about just the intrinsic geometry. That's the kind of difference that Alex was alluding to.
Exactly, I agree. That's the point. So so we are on slide number 7 now. And so look, so the point is that the ACK isolated horizon boundary condition implies certain equations for the kind of variables that we will use in the first order formulation. In particular, one can show that sigma I, and unfortunately, this, I should have defined sigma I in this slide. It will be defined precisely in a moment, but sigma I is essentially E, which E is a bivector that you form with the triad field. So, and you get a single index because you do epsilon I, jk, ej, which, ek. Okay, so sigma I is very much related to the bivectors E, which is just the bivectors E, which E, and also very much related with the densitized triad fields that we are used to in quantum gravity, in the classical formulation that we quantize. So sigma I turns out to be proportional to the curvature of the spin connection. And this so I'm looking at the black equations that you see on top of the yellow equation. These equations are equations that are valid when pulled back to the spheres, two sections, that I will refer to as H. So think of the intersection of a Cauchy surface with our null surface delta. This defines a sphere. If you pull back to those spheres, you obtain these identities are all pulled back on the sphere. So sigma is proportional to S. And the little a that you see there is the area of the black of the isolated horizon, which is the parameter you fixed from the beginning. And then the extrinsic curvature is proportional to the triad, as written in the Black equation. These two equations, together with the definition of the Ashtekar-Barbero connection, imply that the curvature of the Ashtekar-Barbero curvature and the curvature of the Ashtekar-Barbero connection is proportional to sigma, and the proportionality factor depends on the Minsky parameter and A, as in the yellow equation. Okay. So let's go to the next slide, slide number 8. There is an important point concerning the previous equations, and so we're going to have to come back to slide 7 in a moment. So, and in the isolated horizon context, there is no unique notion of surface gravity. The reason is that, unlike the stationary black holes, there is no unique notion of L vector, null vector, tangent normal to the horizon. In the stationary case, we have a unique notion once we choose the killing L, which in particular is also normalized so that at infinity time coincides with time translations. But here we don't have that structure. So in particular, one can rescale the Ls. The theory allows for these rescalings, which I referred to as Lorentz transformations here. So these are, in fact, this can be seen as Lorentz transformations at those points. So one can go from LA to LA tilde and from NA to NA tilde, as in these equations I have there. And so there is this freedom here. And when you rescale these vector fields, you can see that the value of the surface gravity that you would define using the same equation that you use in the stationary case, namely LA grad A of LB equal to some constant kappa times LB, changes, and therefore the value of the surface gravity changes. Now, isolated horizons are happen to satisfy the first law of black hole mechanics. So, with what kappa? Well, in fact, they satisfy a whole bunch of first laws for different values of kappa, there is a way of fixing kappa. So the different values, the different first laws imply different notions of horizon energy functions. And there is so this is all analyzed by Ashtekar and collaborators in various papers. But one thing that happens is that there is a value of the surface gravity which is natural. Among all the possible values, which is the one that makes the first law look just like the first law of stationary black holes. And so in our treatment, we need to choose the L such that the value of kappa we obtain is precisely that. And this is what I referred to in the previous transparency as a thermal slicing. Okay, why is that related to slicing? Well, if you look at the figure on the right, then in our treatment, we require the normal to... So in that figure, you see two Cauchy surfaces, a red one and a blue one, and I have illustrated there the value of the normal vector to the surfaces, to the Cauchy surfaces, at the intersection with the horizon. So you see that depending on how the embedding is at that point, you would have, in the red case, you have this normal slightly tilted toward the horizon, and in the other case, you have it more vertical, in the vertical direction. So it depends on the way the Cauchy surface matches the horizon. So, but if we fix L so that the first law looks like the stationary black hole one, then this allows us to fix the embedding So we need to require the embedding to be fixed so that the normal to M at the intersection is such that it matches L plus N divided by the square root of 2, if you want. So this fixes this ability of doing Lorentz transformations at that point. So the embedding at that point has to be fixed in that way. And this is what allows us to prove equation B on the bottom of that transparency. Namely, for ACK black holes, the surface gravity and the triad is always related by factor. In fact, one can by going to this gauge, then the factor is fixed by a constant being minus square root of 2 pi over a. So if we go back to slide number 7, this is what I said in the main equations, that they hold in what we call the thermal slicing, and that's what I mean by that. So there is this restriction on the way our three, our Cauchy surfaces get there. Okay, but so I've been discussing with Abai last week on all these matters, this restriction, you can always do that for any particular point in the covariant phase space or for any solution of Einstein's equation having an isolated horizon. If I consider the covariant phase space as a whole, then this implies some restrictions this seems to imply some restrictions on the histories from the covariant point of view. It's from the canonical point of view, and those restrictions can be put in an equation, which is equation A. And I think I will postpone the discussion of this to a little bit later. This point has been raised and put by Abai. This will have some consequences, but as we will see, it will not affect the counting. And I must also say that, I mean, a proper, complete understanding of this issue, I mean, obviously this issue is something we have not included in our first analysis. And a complete, proper understanding of this, complete agreement from our side requires a little bit of time. I mean, I just arrived last night, and I called my collaborators, talked to them a few minutes. So, but we will see at the end. I mean, so keep in mind this equation. We'll come back to this in the quantum theory, and we'll see how this might affect or not our result. So let's go to the next slide. We want to consider these isolated horizons as the phase space of these solutions of Einstein's equation. These solutions of Einstein's equations as a phase space, we want to obtain the presymplectic structure associated to this phase space, and in order to eventually quantize and calculate entropy or other properties of these systems. So the first statement is that look at the first equation on top that defines an action. That action, if you're familiar with self-dual variables, you should recognize it as the action of general relativity in complex self-dual variables. This transparency, I need to go through these complex variables for a technical reason, and then we'll go back to real variables. So for the moment, think that we are in the context of self-dual variables, the Aschnecker variables, and then the action is the one written on top there. One needs a boundary term at infinity, if one is imposing asymptotically flat boundary conditions, for the action to be differentiable, so the action principle to be well-defined. But it turns out that there is no need of internal boundary term. We can use the very same action principle for our isolated horizon system. One can show that the boundary term that would be generated when one does variations of this action is just vanishes identically due to the isolated horizon boundary condition. So the action, then one can construct the symplectic current associated to these complex variables, which is written in equation A, which essentially say that the delta, the sigma i's are the conjugate of the ai's. And a very general property of the symplectic structure, the symplectic current that comes from Einstein's equations, in one of these general properties that we can prove using the covariance space formulation, is that J must be closed. Therefore, the integral of J on any closed surface must vanish due to Stokes' theorem. So let me take the shaded region on the figure you see there, which is bounded on the future by M2, on the past by M1, at infinity by a cylinder of infinite radius, which I just depicted as I naught there, and on the left by the portion of the isolated horizon that I call delta. The integral of J, the flux of J on the boundary of this region must vanish. So we get this first equation C, the first identity in equation C, 0 equal to the integral on the boundary of B of J, which now splits into three contributions. One contribution, which is just the integral of the symplectic current on the delta, plus the contribution on M1, plus the contribution on M2, and one contribution at infinity, which vanishes if proper fall-off conditions are imposed. So the key point, which one can prove, and proof I'm not giving it here, is that the first term, which is the flux across the null portion of the boundary, splits into two contributions, one at H1 and one at H2, where H1 and H2 are the intersections between M1 and M2 with delta. Okay, so these are two spheres. So the flux across delta splits into two terms, which have the form of some factor times an integral of the symplectic current of NSU2 Chan-Simons theory. Okay. Which means that I can reorganize the terms in equation C to prove that the following symplectic structure is conserved. So let's go to page 10 and look at equation B. So the symplectic structure that contains a bulk contribution given by the usual presymplectic structure of self-dual variables, plus this boundary term that is a Chan-Simons type boundary term, is conserved in the sense of equation A, namely that it's independent of M. If I evaluate it on M1 or M2, I get the same result. So now if I impose the reality conditions, namely if I replace A, self-dual A, by what you see in equation C, the first equation C, one can show, and again, that is proven in our long paper that is about to come out, that the imaginary part of this symplectic structure vanishes. I must say that all this mimics very much the logic of the U1 formulation. Okay, so all these things. What I mean is we have not invented all of this. This is very much inspired by what is done in the U1 case. So finally, so the imaginary part of this symplectic structure written in B is zero, and so this symplectic structure is just real. And if you evaluate what the real part of this, which is just you see that you obtain equation D, which is a very important equation. So in terms of sigma k variables, the symplectic structure has no boundary term. Okay? That's the conserved symplectic structure of isolated horizons, without boundary terms in terms of sigma k variables. So we will see in a moment that the appearance of a boundary symplectic structure is very much related to the use of these connection variables. Okay. Let's go to, so keep in mind equation D. Okay. It's an important question. So let's go to page 11. So in 11 is a brief review of how we get the Aztec Barbero variables. And I think it's important to give you an intuition of how this boundary symplectic structure arises. So let me go quickly through this. You are all familiar with this. So how do we introduce the new variables? One can do canonical analysis of general relativity in terms of ADM variables, and one would get the symplectic structure written there in the second line in terms of ADM variables, where Q is 3-metric and pi is the momentum conjugate to the 3-metric, which are defined in the figure there, but you are familiar with these things, and details are not important. Now, the first step towards connection variables is to rewrite or to parametrize this 3-metric QAB in terms of a triad field. And so one can see that, and now I'm looking at the set of equations and text in the middle of the transparency with these big red arrows. So in writing the 3-metric in terms of a triad, you can go to new canonical variables, which are the sigma, and finally you see the definition of sigma that I should have written before. Sigma I equal this in terms of these triad fields, what you see there in the middle, and one introduces this Ki, the extrinsic curvature component, in terms of the second fundamental form of on the Cauchy surface. So, and these turned out to be canonical variables. So the symplectic form can be written as in the equation A below, the first identity of equation A. Okay. Now, the final step is to introduce these Aztec-Barbero variables in which you essentially introduce a connection by adding to the spin connection, the torsion-free connection, gamma associated to E, the Mirsky parameter, little gamma, times Ki. And so you can show that this last step is, in fact, a canonical transformation. So let's see why this is a canonical transformation. And for the moment, let's assume that there are no boundaries. So M is compact. So the reason why this is a canonical transformation is explained in the last line, where you see that in order to, the first identity gives a definition of the presymplectic potential for the presymplectic form written in sigma k variables, as you can see. If I vary this thing, I obtain the symplectic form written in sigma and k variables. Now, I can add and subtract to this thing this integral. So now look at the second identity. I add and subtract integral on m of sigma I wedge delta gamma I. And so the first term I get is the symplectic potential for the symplectic structure written in sigma Aztec-Barbero variables, and sigma and A, where A is the Aztec-Barbero connection. And the second term turns out to be, and this is an important property of the spin connection in three dimensions, that sigma I wedge delta I is equal to a total derivative. So in the absence of boundaries, the term I have added and subtracted is just zero. So that's why this is a canonical transformation, and we can write this presymplectic structure as an equation in the last identity of equation A. Okay, so let's go to page 12 and re-study these things for the case in which there are boundaries of M. So, in particular, when there is an isolated horizon. So we've seen that, I have argued, and that the symplectic structure in terms of sigma k variables is the one given on top there. No need of adding any boundary term. Now the symplectic potential associated to that symplectic structure is written on equation A. Now I just play the same game as before. I add and subtract something to this presymplectic potential, the red integrals that you see there in equation A. And I obtain equation B. On the first line, we have, the first line, which I didn't do anything. And the second line, I have replaced already this combination of K and the spin connection by the Ashton-Caravero connection. There should be an I index on top of A on the second line on equation B. I forgot. And I have replaced the fact that the integral on M of sigma I wedge delta I becomes a boundary term, which contributes with a boundary term to the symplectic potential. So if I vary this symplectic potential, which is just the symplectic potential that leads to the right presymplectic structure, I obtain equation C, in which you recognize the bulk presymplectic structure corresponds, the usual one for, that we like and know connection variables, plus a boundary contribution of the form integral on the horizon of delta 1 EI, delta 2 EI. So, in fact, this would be a possible way to go to address the question of quantizing the edge of the horizon and getting the entropy. One could try to quantize this theory in the bulk is loop quantum gravity. On the surface is a theory of triads which have this special symplectic structure, so there are certain commutation relations, and where certain conditions must be imposed for this for the geometry on the horizon to be compatible with the geometry in the bulk, a version of isolated horizon boundary condition in terms of this value. So we're not going to do this, but I just wanted to show this. That, and by the way, this implies that the presence of a boundary term is directly related to the fact that we want to, use this connection variable. So it's in this canonical transformation that we obtain this boundary term. But there is a point I want to say, which I like about this presymplectic structure written as in C, which is the following. If you look at the Poisson brackets that are induced by this boundary term on equation C, imply that if I define the flux as in this red square below, the flux of sigma by the usual way as an integral on the horizon, on some part of the horizon that I call S, of the trace of some SU2 smearing alpha in some in the Lie algebra of SU2 and sigma, this object, the symplectic structure C, the boundary symplectic structure C, implies that the commutation relation between these fluxes is the one written there. So it's the SU2. So when you commute two fluxes, you get the flux evaluated on the commutator, on the Lie algebra of alpha with beta. One flux with alpha, one flux with beta, you get the flux in the commutator alpha with beta. I find this very, very nice because already we are clearly seeing the kind of commutation relations we know we're going to obtain in the quantum theory for these fluxes. And so similar kind of commutation relations are obtained in the classical theory in the usual when there are no boundaries. When one considers the holonomy flux algebra, but what I like about this here is that even before I said in which way I will, which are going to be my basic variables, namely generalized connections and fluxes, we see already that these fluxes are non-commuting on this price. Okay, so that was just a side remark. So let's go to slide number 13. Okay, instead of playing the game of slide number 12, we're going to do something else. So again, we start with the symplectic structure in terms of sigma k variables, which has no boundary terms. We write the presymplectic potential, which is written in blue there. Look at the first line. We have added what we needed to get the presymplectic potential of Barbero variables, and we have subtracted something there. In the second line, the something is precisely the presymplectic potential of an SU2-Chern-Simon theory. Okay? So look at the second line of the blue equation. In the second line, the only thing I've done is to just replace sigma I with delta gamma I by the boundary term it gives. So the point is that this combination of things that that has an under bracket there can be shown in the covariance to be a closed form in the covariance phase space, namely that variations of this thing are zero. Okay? Second variations of this thing is zero. Therefore, what I'm proving here is that this symplectic potential I've written there reproduces the symplectic structure that on top. Okay? Because the next variations will just kill this thing I have added. So instead of adding just zero as in the previous slide, I have added a closed form, okay, which corresponds again to a canonical transformation. So that means that if I take, that means that the symplectic structure in terms of the A and K variables can be written as in the red line on the bottom of transparency number 13. Where we see again that we have a bulk term corresponding to usual thing, and a boundary term which corresponds to an SU2 Chern-Simon theory with a certain level. And this is one of the main points of the classical analysis. So now this provides the strategy for going to the quantum theory. Unlike what we had in page number 12, now we have Chern-Simon theory on the boundary with the Chern-Simon pre-symplectic structure and a Chern-Simon-like constraint equation, which is the equation on top of the red equation there. So the strategy, unlike the previous case, we know very well, we know a lot about quantizing SU2 Chern-Simon theory. Well, people certainly know very well, and we know a lot, and we know how to use what people have done about quantization of SU2 Chern-Simon theory. So now we know how to keep going and answer the question that we want to answer. So let's go to slide number 14. So we have all the ingredients for quantization. The idea is to quantize the degrees of freedom in the bulk in the usual quantum gravity way, and to quantize the degrees of freedom, to quantize this Chern-Simon connection on the boundary by using what we know about quantizing Chern-Simon theory, and impose on our states the boundary condition that is written there in green under the first item, number one. And we impose this strongly because, I mean, from the point of view of this Chern-Simon theory, these constraints are first class constraints. They are responsible for maintaining SU2 gauge invariance. Yeah. And I will get back to some details of this thing, but so let me say that one can, well, now define entropy by the log of the best way to write what entropy is by introducing a density matrix. But let's say, loosely speaking for a moment, and that S is given by the log of a number of states, which are surface states, in a sense that I will comment on in a moment. And this number of states turned out to be a sum of all possible configurations of punctures. The punctures are provided by these ends of spin networks that end on the two sphere and produce a conical singularity of the curvature of the Chern-Simon connection. So this, the number of configurations here by the sum of all possible puncturing up to diffeomorphisms of the dimension of the Chern-Simon Hilbert spaces, which are labeled by the spin levels J1 to Jn for a given number of punctures. Now, formulas like this were around before. Karl and Manjunder have looked at these things. Krasnov, I think, in some very, very early has pointed out that one could compute the entropy this way. There is also Kaldip, totally independent derivation of black hole entropy, which is very much related with this kind of counting. And one important thing is that, of course, the J's of the punctures are constrained so that the sum of the square root of J plus 1 must be less than the area of the black hole. So namely, you consider only those puncture configurations for which the eigenvalue of the area is below the macroscopic area. and you put just below because, that's enough to get the entropy result. Right. You can also consider between area and area minus epsilon, area plus epsilon, with some given epsilon. And so now the counting using our formulation has been very precisely done by these people here that you see on the bottom by the Madrid group, and maybe that's not a good but the Spanish people you see down there, Argulio, Barbero, Borja, Diaz Polo, and Villaseñor. And there are some new ideas by Karim that lead to very, very nice counting, which is probably compatible, of course, with the other methods, and we hope to be able to put this out also very soon. Let's go to next slide. But a beautiful thing about this formulation, the SE2 formulation, is that for a certain range of the immunity parameter, the area constraint that you see there written red, green in the middle of the transparency. Well, first look at the first equation up on the top. It turns out that the dimension of the Hilbert space of Chern Simon theory with n punctures and n j's is always smaller than the dimension of something that is very simple, the invariant component of the tensor product of j1 to jm representation. Okay? And in the limit in which the level of a Chern Simon theory tends to infinity, the dimensions coincide, and there is a one-to-one correspondence between between basis vectors in the Hilbert space of Chern Simon theory and basis vectors in the invariant space of the tensor product of representation. Now, in general, this is not true. For finite level, this is not true. Now, something very nice happens with the area constraint. If you bring in the area constraint, which is written there below the picture of the black hole, this constraint alone implies, and for a certain range of immunity parameters, implies that there is a one-to-one correspondence between physical states, elements of a basis in the Hilbert space of Chern Simon theory, and a basis in the invariant tensor product of the J1 to JM. So we can model, so this one-to-one correspondence lets us think of these physical states as in terms of SE2 intertwiners, if you want. And this is nice because it just matches some ideas. It's related with some ideas that are explore in the literature of describing a black hole in terms of these things. In fact, it's very much consistent with the very, very early calculations of black hole literature by Carlo. And so if you go to page 16, nothing changes. The only thing, this is an effect that is difficult to make in a phone call talk. So when you go to page 16, the only thing I'm just showing that one can represent these physical states just as a bookkeeping device, so there are one-to-one correspondence between them as an intertwiner, which is this black thing that it's just a graphical representation of an intertwiner, matching, intertwining all the representations in all the punctures to retrieve the representation. So let's go to page 17. Okay, so now I'd like to talk about the relationship between what we do and what was done in the U1 treatment. Okay, so in the U1 treatment, there is a certain tension or ambiguity as far as the counting is concerned. And some people usually use these names, so I'm using the same names. They refer to the Domagala-Lewandowski prescription of counting and the Gauss-Mitra counting. Okay, so let me tell you what these things are. In fact, in both cases, one solves the same constraint equation. So physical states are the same in both in both cases. The difference is how we count configurations, horizon configurations. So in both cases, we solve the analog of U1 Simon series source equation, which is the black equation you see on, let's look at first the Domagal-Lewandowski counting. This equation in black is strongly imposed on physical states. Now, if you look at the classical, if you go back to the classical theory, you see that in addition to this component of the constraint, you should also impose other two conditions, which is that namely that the components of the flux in the direction normal to this internal vector Ri that you fix in the U1 formulation must vanish, which is which cannot be imposed strongly in the U1 treatment because, as you know, I mean, in the quantum theory, we cannot have sigma I does not commute with sigma j, right, in the quantum theory. These fluxes are non-commuting things, so we cannot impose the other two equations simultaneously, so one imposes them only weakly. And of course, one doesn't need to do anything. In fact, one can show that the solutions of the first equation are such that then the matrix elements between physical states of the normal components of the flux are just automatically zero. So this is nice. This is this takes care in this weaker sense than the other two components. So this is these other two constraints are imposed in a kind of Gupta-Bloyer sense. So, and keep in mind of course, if I have some subset in which this expectation value, these matrix elements are zero, I can always, if I have a space in which expectation values of these matrix elements are zero, I can always take a smaller subspace and they will still be zero. So, okay, now let me go to the difference between the counting. What is the difference in the counting? So, the difference is how you construct the density metric. Okay? So, we want to count on the surface states. By that, we mean that we want to trace out bulk degrees of freedom. Of course, we have to do that. If we don't do that, we will get an infinite entropy because there are infinitely many local degrees of freedom in the bulk. So one needs to provide a prescription of tracing out bulk degrees of freedom. And that is what makes the difference between the Ghosh-Mitra and the Domagala-Lewandowski counting. In the Domagala-Lewandowski counting, one considers that only connection construct in terms of the U1 connection are surface observables. So in particular, two states, as the one I written up there, that are labeled by different J's but with the same magnetic number M, are to be counted only once. And this is what I mean, not a very nice way by this approximately equal. What I mean is really that there are two states, two physical states satisfying the constraints. But you count only once because you're tracing out. You don't care about the J value. The J value is not an observable that you can construct in terms of the connection. While in the Ghosh-Mitra counting, one considers these two states as different states. So JM and J prime M are different states, so we count them twice. And this amounts for tracing out bulk degrees of freedom where both connection and the area density are surface observables. But now, the area density must be one of our observables, in my view, because the intrinsic geometry of the horizon is one of our fundamental quantities in the definition of isolated horizons. In particular, if you look at quantization of Ashtecker, Engel, and Van der Broek of distorted isolated horizons, one clearly sees there that is for the case of axisymmetric horizons, one constructs all sorts, infinitely many observables, which depend on the J. In particular, I have in mind this spherical quantum spherical harmonics and et cetera. So the thing that is consistent with those treatments and consistent with the notion that area density should be one of our surface observables is Gauss-Mitre counting. So we trace out bulk degrees of freedoms, but the J's, different J's count. So now let's go to the next slide. And so we get to the SU2 counting. Well, one advantage of the SU2 formulation is that we impose this equation in the red frame, the red box, strongly, because this equation in our context is a first-class constraint, is a set of first-class constraints generating SU2 gauge transformation. So there's no issue about imposing weakly some of the conditions. We're imposing them all simultaneously. Well, it's true that that in the quantum SU2 John Simon theory is a delicate beast. So in the quantum theory, there are things that happen. In particular, one doesn't have really SU2 as gauge symmetry, but some deformed version of SU2, SU2Q. But at least at the classical level, these are first-class constraints. Then we impose them according to using the treatment of the standard quantization of John Simon theory. So now density magic is constructed by tracing out bulk degrees of freedoms. And here the question is much less ambiguous because it's obvious here for the SU2 theory, the J's obviously matter. We cannot trace out the J's. The J's are intertwined. So J's, the connection knows about both J's and M's. So we use, we trace out bulk degrees of freedoms by considering area density and connection, observables, surface observables, and that's the way we do the counting. Now, so I said that it was going to lead to the end this issue that Abai has raised concerning this additional constraint that our configuration should satisfy, which is the red equation of, that I have rewritten in equation A. So you see that this equation A is a very it's a very nice equation. So if we were to impose that equation, only by assuming that there is at least one solution of equation A per surface state, namely per physical state satisfying the John-Simons constraint, then our counting would be completely unaffected, because volume has to do with additional structure that is in the bulk and is not part of the degrees of freedoms that are surface degrees of freedom. So we only count intrinsic geometry degrees of freedom. So the volume is not part of that. So in constructing the density matrix, that information would just go out, and in our calculation of our counting will remain the same.
So, Alex, I have a comment here. I'm sorry, but I can't wait till the end because I have to give a talk in just a few minutes in Maryland. The thing is that it seems to me that there is pluses and minuses in both those cases. At the moment, we have so little control on the spectrum of the volume operator that we don't know that, in fact, there is at least one state in the bulk which corresponds to this. So, I mean, the way that, I'm the one who suggested to you that one can put it this way. I mean, so I am quite sympathetic with this viewpoint. But on the other hand, I think we should say that, in principle, it is possible that this is not the case, and that there is actually an additional restriction, and that is why there are, the counting, you know, is slightly different. I mean, in the U1 counting, there is a problem, or not a problem, but there is the point that you pointed out, which is namely that it is not possible to impose the constraints which are orthogonal to the internal vector Ri, and therefore they are imposed as expectation value constraints, and they are imposed as expectation value constraints because it is inconsistent to do anything else. And it is consistent to this, and it is actually satisfied. But in the SU2 case, I think the reason why one went to Ri in the U1 case, why one went to U1 in the U1 case is because one had fixed an internal vector Ri. Now, in the present understanding is that one avoids that in the SU2 case, but at the price of this additional constraint. And I think at this stage, one should say that, well, we don't know which way it is going to go. I don't think that one can say.
No, I agree. I will make some comments concerning this in the following transparencies. But
I wanted to bring that in the even, unfortunately. Yeah.
One could. True that perhaps not impose this as an eigenvalue equation, but I think it would be difficult not to be able to impose this as an expectation.
Right.
I don't know. This is a question that I agree with you. We have to analyze in more detail, and we didn't have much time since our interaction so recent. And and one thing I will say later, if we are not there, is that I think one can avoid altogether this issue also by keeping the SO2. We are not sure, but we think we can avoid this this difficulty, in particular if we want to generalize our formulation to the most modern isotope horizon boundary condition. So,
We are on the same wavelength. Thank you.
Alex, can I say something? This is John.
Yeah.
Yeah, as you know, actually, I have not yet been convinced that this extra constraint is necessary. Abai argues that it comes from the fact that we're fixing this vector RA, but I don't see how we're fixing this vector RA. This is something which I've not yet seen why. I mean, it's true that if we're given a geometry, we're using a certain preferred normal L, which is determined by the geometry, but the geometry is not being fixed. I mean, the geometry is a function on phase space, non-trivial, and also L and N are non-trivial functions on phase space. So I'm confused as to where this is coming from.
But, so I disagree with that, with what you just said. Namely, it is certainly true that in a geometry, one is fixing L and N, but when one constructs a phase space, one is putting conditions on the data, on the initial, on the canonical pair of data that we have. And I'm claiming that unless you put the condition that you only allow those canonical pairs of data, or if you like, those solutions of in the covariant phase space of Einstein's equation, which on the boundary will give you L and N that you have fixed in order to get the surface gravity to be right and so on and so forth. Okay. So unless you do that, you would not get a good Hamiltonian formulation. The variation principles would not be well defined.
What would not be well defined?
The variational principles would not be well defined. In the way that the isolated horizon framework has been actually published, one has fixed an internal vector Li, and that was absolutely essential for the variational principles and the symplectic structure and everything to be well defined. Even the action principle is not well defined without that. I'm completely willing to believe that you don't have to fix Li, but you can fix a space-time vector La. But then, at the end of the day, when you do your phase space in the canonical picture, this corresponds to saying that in the canonical picture, there is actually a vector field RA that is sitting there, and this vector field is, of course, just given by the L and N vector fields in the covariant phase space that are given there. So L and N give you both the unit normal and this R vector. The unit normal is important so that you don't make boosts in order for your extrinsic curvature formula to work. But for the same reason that you have got the unit normal there, the time-like normal there, you also have a space-like normal RA everywhere on this, so to say, on this bare manifold with the boundary that you have fixed in order to do your Hamiltonian framework. But I agree, this is a delicate point. It's not so easy to discuss it in the seminar framework. But I'm very happy to go through it in detail.
Okay.
Well, yeah, so
we have... You should just finish, Alex, right?
Okay, so let me continue. And I agree with you, John, also. I mean, we this is something we have to look in detail to see really... and to see that it's unavoidable, because as I said, I think if we want to generalize this to distorted black holes, et cetera, we might be able to avoid this issue altogether. We'll talk about this in future. So let me just finish. So one more comment about page 18. We are on page 18. Now we are imposing this constraint, and let me just make the remark that the number of states that we are counting, the states that we are counting, is in a very precise sense, are a subset of the states that are counted in the Domagala, in the Ghosh-Mitra setting. So our states, our conditions are stronger because we are, which might be probably obvious to you, we are imposing three constraints strongly. But the black hole entropy, now go to page 19, when you do the counting, and for a certain range of the emissivity parameter, which is this gamma less than square root of 3, where this corresponds to classical SU2 intertwiners holes, we find an entropy, I mean, Argullo, Barbero, Borges, Diaz, Polo, and Vita Senor have calculated this precisely, and one finds that the leading order term is exactly the same that one finds in the U1 Ghosh-Mitra prescription, while the logarithmic correction, the subleading correction, has a minus 3 half log of A instead of a minus 1 half. So this is also a way of seeing that we have less states. And the 3 halves, as Amit Ghosh has pointed out, is the 3 in the 3 halves is very much related to the fact that we impose 3 constraints strongly instead of only 1. And this is the emissivity parameter that makes the entropy equal to 1/4 of the area, as calculated by these people. And so let me just finish if we are late by going to next slide, future. Well, put our long paper with all the details and presumably dealing in detail with these things that Bai has brought up. Extend our things to the general definition of isolated horizons, analyze the distorted and rotating cases, and of course we hope that by doing this treatment, which is more symmetric and preserves the symmetries of the box theory, we might have this is just a hope, better insights maybe in the other issues concerning dynamics and Hawking radiation. And with that, I finish. Thank you very much.
Questions? I have a question. So this ambiguity of the null generators is not present in the stationary case?
In the stationary case, there is a preferred null generator, which is the one that coincides with the killing, which is the killing generator. Now, if you have a killing vector field, two times the killing vector field is still a killing vector field. But you fix that ambiguity by requiring that since you have a killing vector field which is well-defined inside the space-time, you can go to infinity and fix that normalization, if you want, by requiring that at infinity this corresponds to a time translation.
And if I take the limit angular momentum going to zero, that doesn't select a preferred case in the spherical case?
I'm not sure if I understand. You mean if I take stationary rotating black holes?
Yes.
And take the limit?
Rotation going to zero. Wouldn't that pick a preferred generator?
Well, I have in the stationary Schwarzschild case, I have a preferred generator by using the procedure I just said. And in the general case, so for all the family of Kern-Newman, for the whole Kern-Newman family, there is a preferred L.
Okay.
Which is the killing L. fact, is something like t being the these are stationary spacetime. So one has the stationary Killing field, the one that generates time translations. So t by dt in the usual coordinate. So let me call it t plus omega of the horizon psi, where psi is the one that generates rotations around the z-axis or the axis symmetry, the fact that these solutions are axis symmetric. This combination of two Killing fields with the constant coefficient, which is this omega, is the L. Evaluated at the horizon is the L. I prefer L.
More questions? Okay, if there are no more questions, let's thank Alejandro again.